Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, Ampersand Magazine publishes stories and journalism about environments, natural and constructed, and our place in both. The magazine is an offshoot of Forterra, an organization dedicated to conservation and creating sustainable connections between human society and nature. As the publishers say, the ampersand binds the two reasons Forterra exists, people and place. The magazine and its mission came to life recently in an evening of storytelling, poetry, and entertainment. In this presentation, you'll hear the voices of radio hosts, dog trainers and chocolatiers, poets, foragers, artists, and designers, all passionate about our sense of place here in the Northwest. This event took place at Town Hall Seattle on November 12, 2015. Thanks to Florangela Davila for our recording. Please note one thing that will make sense later. Samson took 25 seconds to find the scat. Here, MC Luke Burbank kicks off the evening.
Hello there, Town Hall. How's everybody doing? Welcome to the second Ampersand get-together. My name is Luke Burbank. I'll be guiding you all through tonight. You might be wondering what the plan is. Well, we're all here tonight because of a great organization called Forterra, some of you may be familiar with. And Forterra works really hard to preserve this part of the country we live in and also to preserve the sense of place that we all love so much about this part of the Northwest. And my association with this part of the world goes back to when I was 4 years old and we moved here from Northern California. It was the week before Mount St. Helens exploded. And I was a young kid and not great with geography. So when I saw the cover of the Seattle Times and saw the picture of Mount St. Helens exploding, I assumed it was down the street and that I was pretty much going to die. And I remember thinking, you had a good run, Burbank. It was a very terrifying time for me because one of my main fears as a child was hot lava. I assumed hot lava or quicksand would be one of the two ways that I died based on the cartoons that I watched, which is foolish now looking back on it, because what we realize is that the greatest threat to any of us at this point is accidentally eating gluten in a muffin. It's the not-so-silent killer. My family moved to the Green Lake area, which is pretty much where I grew up, but not the fancy part of Green Lake. I grew up essentially on Aurora Avenue, at 77th and Aurora Avenue, and I went to an elementary school, which now I'm told is quite the destination, Daniel Bagley Elementary School. But got some Bagley bees in the house. Well, when I started at Daniel Bagley in the 1980s, they taught you a poem on your first day of school because they'd been having some real problems they were trying to address. And the poem was, "Share a toy, share a ride, share the feelings deep inside. But never share a hat or comb, or lice could make your head their home." My dad had a little sign shop on Aurora Avenue called Signworks, and I went by that part of Aurora the other day, and I have to admit I was feeling kind of wistful because between 77th and 85th on Aurora, everything has changed. Every single business that was there has turned into recreational marijuana. 100% of them are now recreational marijuana, which, as we know, in the life cycle of any retail location, is the end point. Starts off as a Blockbuster Video, maybe a furniture store, and then, like a salmon going to spawn, it eventually becomes recreational marijuana, with a possible stop as a karate dojo in between. I went to Nathan Hale High School, graduated as a proud Raider. When I was a senior, I became the father of a young daughter because I felt like it was time. A lot of you know what I'm talking about. You just get to the point where you've really done the whole junior year thing and you're ready. And then I went on to the University of Washington. I ended up working at a great public radio station here in town, KUOW. And, yeah. It wasn't until I moved out of Seattle, though, that I realized what an amazing place the Northwest is. I became a reporter for NPR, and so I lived in New York and L.A. and a lot of other places. And what I didn't realize until I got to those cities was that there isn't anywhere like this. And one of the things I think that's so amazing about the Northwest is the way that you have the sort of miracle of nature interacting and intersecting so closely with the miracle of human development. Actually, the way that I came to be hosting this thing tonight is I was hanging out with Florangela Davila from Forterra, who put this whole thing together, by the way. We should give her a little round of applause. She told me I would get an Applebee's gift certificate if I said that, so pay up. Florangela and I were out on Lake Union talking about this thing because I have an old classic wooden boat because I like making terrible financial decisions. And we were on this little boat on Lake Union, and we were just marveling at this beautiful body of water that's right in the middle of this city and surrounded by all this design and creativity and energy that goes on. And the thing about this part of the world is, if you look in any direction, you will see a construction crane. Okay, but if you look past that, you'll probably see a pho place. But if you keep, like, really look a little further, you will see the most beautiful natural scenery, really, anywhere in the country. And it's, you don't have to go to the top of a mountain for it. You don't have to go to the middle of the woods. It's actually woven through our cities, and it's woven through the people in these cities. And those are the people that we have tonight to talk to you about this sense of place. You want to hear from them? All right, let's get started.
Sorry, I have entrance music wherever I go, so... I'm also a DJ at a public radio station, KEXP. My name is John Richards. Thank you. I was here last night for 2 hours talking about music and death. It's a talk I do every year. It was a very serious talk, and I'd just like to say the 5 minutes I'm going to do right now is a vacation right now. This is a brilliant evening after talking 2 hours about death. It is so good to be here talking about my community. One of the songs that you just heard was from Run DMC. I do playlists. It's what I do for a living. I live in this city, and I love it. I love everything about it. Even the hour and a half drive it took me to get 5 miles to get here this evening. And this is a dream come true for me to be able to bitch about Green Lake a little bit in front of all of you. That's my talk. I've lived very close to Green Lake all of my life. Just like Luke mentioned, I live just a few blocks from it right now, as a matter of fact. And one thing I see when I see Green Lake is I see it as a symbol of how we live in this city. And that includes all the signs and symbols telling you to go one way, yet 10% of everybody is going the wrong way. No matter what I do, I can't help these people from understanding you're going the wrong way. And I do what we Seattleites do best. I pass those people, and I bitch about it 5 minutes later to my wife, never confronting these people and the wrong that they are doing as they cross Green Lake and go the wrong way. But if you start to pay attention to the people around Green Lake, you really start to learn some things. They really aren't bad people. They just are in the moment. I've actually not being a Seattleite, I actually for a second stopped being one and asked a few of these people, and they just didn't think it was for them. They just felt like they're in the moment, they're with their family, and they're just going the wrong way. If you pay attention, you'll see volunteers actually cleaning the lake. You'll actually see people are doing all right and helping each other out. You'll hear music and you'll see people running as they listen to songs like this. Frightened Rabbit is this band. It's called Swim Until You Can't See Land. Now, Frightened Rabbit might work as well, because let's face it, the rabbits are gone. I probably could have picked a song about geese as well, but that's a whole other story. Those poor bastards. Removed long ago from Green Lake. We swim Green Lake when we shouldn't. We have to shower and use hydrogen peroxide and clean out our ears and our eyes when we're training for a triathlon, but yet we still swim it. Toxic algae forms. We don't clean it. We wait for it to get better, and we still watch those fishermen out there mercifully fishing the waters of Green Lake and possibly eating those fish later, which really scares me, especially as a vegan. We see those signs go up, and yet we can't do anything about the ducks who don't know any better but to swim in it. And we continue to go around in circles, like this song from Soul Coffee, In Circles. We walk around and we see people we don't know, but we see people we recognize now. The guy who gives free Spanish lessons around Green Lake. I love that man and I never want him to stop, right? The busker who tells the worst jokes on God's green earth is there. You know who I'm talking about. The Rat City Roller Girls who rule and are spinning every day around their training. The cat, have you seen the cat on the shoulder bike guy? That's impressive. The hand organ guy. We keep thinking he's going to have a monkey. He doesn't have a monkey, but he does have the hand organ. And every day we're both annoyed and excited that he's there. He's like an old friend. There's people with packs training to climb Rainier and the homeless walking the park with all their belongings, yet are still doing laps around the parks and not just stopping, but actually seeing the rest of us as we pass. When we ride our bikes, like this song, the bike song from Mark Ronson, I run the lake almost every day. It's 2.8 on the inside. It's 3.2 on the outside. I can run it in 21 minutes on a good day. I can walk it. Well, it all depends on my two-year-old. That's how long it usually takes. He decides. I'm told if you do the 3.2 miles on the outside, though, you're actually breathing in more pollution and doing more harm to your body than good. Yet there we are running the lake on the outside track. Just like a lot of us, I didn't notice bikes on the outside until my son started riding a bike, and then I got serious about how we treat each other on that trail, because it's important that we go the right direction. And we have to actually speak to each other and make sure that we're going the right direction, that we're respecting not just ourselves but each other, and to me, the parks are a place to do that. I was asked what my favorite place was in Seattle outside of my work at KEXP, in my home with my children and my wife. And I've been going to Green Lake for 20 years. I would sit and write postcards at that lake to my friends back in Spokane, making fun of them because they were still in Spokane, but really, really scared that I was in the city I didn't quite understand yet. I would run and think about my future in the city. I watched Sean Kemp dunk a basketball at the courts of Green Lake in one of my better moments of my life. I watched our city grow up there. I've moved many times in Seattle like a lot of you. But I've run it, and I've continued to use it as my place to get away in Seattle. I've dealt with my depression around that lake. I've dealt with my relationships around that lake. I've watched as my son has grown up around that lake. I've watched paddleboarders. I've watched runners, swimmers, the wading pool, ducks, geese. I've watched the disabled go around that lake. I've seen the senior citizens cross around that lake. These gathering spaces are so important to us, and places like Green Lake show our humanity, and they show what this city is so great about. There's candles for those who died at Hiroshima every year around that lake. There are pianos in the park. When the sprinklers went off and nearly destroyed that first piano in the park, our citizens gathered and covered that piano. A small theater, countless runs for cancer, and a listener of mine who was attacked when they were having terrible attacks on women around that lake was attacked one morning while listening to my show, and someone on a bike stopped and saved her from what could have been death. Those are our people. Those are our people looking out for one another. Green Lake represents for me all the good there is, and it tells me 10% just aren't quite sure what to do. They aren't sure to go the right way. And every time I go to Green Lake, I know I'm going to run into somebody that I know and love. And I swear to God, if they're going the wrong way, I'm going to kill them. I love that lake. I love this city. And as long as we have these parks in our cities, it gives us reason to pause. It gives us reason to reflect. And we can put up with all the development that's going on around us. I thank you for listening to me tonight. And I hope to see you around Green Lake on the inside track of the park.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. My name is Julianne Ubigo, and this is Samson. We are both employees of the Center for Conservation Biology. It's part of the University of Washington, part of a unique program called the Conservation Canine Program. Samson, sit. Good boy. I'm here to tell the story of Samson tonight. Okay, sit. Stay. As someone who's traveled quite a bit, he's wondering what we're doing up here. As someone who's traveled quite a bit, I've always been really, really proud to say that I'm from Seattle. Down. And I think it's because Seattle, to me, represents individuality and passion and people who aren't afraid of being different. And I'm here to tell the story of Samson tonight because Samson is a little bit different. Right now, he's a little anxious because I have his favorite thing in the world tucked up under my armpit. It's a ball. Every conservation canine handler walks the fields doing wildlife research on a daily basis with a ball tucked into our pocket or under our arm. Down. Now, to Samson, the fact that I have this with me makes him think that he's gonna get to go to work, which is his favorite thing in the world. Quiet. Okay. He loves his job, and he helps us discover more about endangered and threatened wildlife all over the world. Stay. Samson's story starts on the streets of Seattle. He was a homeless dog, deemed crazy, deemed obnoxious, and untrainable. You get... Now, I was hoping to come here and prove that wrong, but he does have a personality, and his personality makes him perfect for the job that he has. Samson, down. We have 18 dogs in the program. Our training facility is outside of Eatonville, Washington. And all of the dogs in our program, down, relax. All of the dogs in our program have one thing in common, and that's that they're crazy about playing fetch, crazy about that thing over there, the B-A-L-L. We hate to say the word too much. Now, we select dogs who are deemed... High five. We select dogs that are deemed unadoptable because no matter how hard the shelters try to train certain behaviors out of them, they just won't give it up. They're passionate, and that's, I think, what makes me so proud of him. We adopted him in 2008. I don't know the story of his first 4 years of life, but I do know the story of his life since that day we picked him up at the shelter in 2008 because we've been working together ever since. Samson and I have been... He doesn't do this too often. Samson and I have been working together. We've gone to San Diego. We've gone to British Columbia, Alberta. There's his crazy face. That's him doing what he loves to do. And I am so proud to be his coworker in the field. He was considered crazy, but we found that the assets, the things that he had that made him, the downfalls that he had that the shelter described of him were actually assets to us. And at the University of Washington, we use these dogs to help find the scat of wildlife, of endangered and threatened animals. And it's the drive of him wanting to find that ball that helps us find incredible amounts of data in the field every day. Samson is really hoping to get to show you tonight what he gets to do on a daily basis. I'm going to try very hard to make tonight as fun for him as it is for all of us. So we're going to end tonight with a very quick demonstration. It's why he's barking. It's what he really wants to do. He's going to find a little sample that I've placed on the stage. But the little sample is a vial. It has the scat of a Pacific pocket mouse in it, which is the scat is about the size of a sesame seed, so it's extremely small. Before we do that, I'd just like to thank everyone for inviting us here today. We really feel honored to be part of wildlife research, and we also are very honored that we are able to rescue dogs who have a high energy drive and an interesting personality find what others can deem to be crazy as assets that help us in our wildlife conservation every day. Thank you so much. Give Samson a round of applause after he finds his cat. Are you ready? All right.
Good evening. I don't think I can follow that. I'm so in love with that dog that I can't talk right now. My heart's going crazy. Hi, my name is Janie Miller. I'm one of the poets talking to you this evening. I truly can't concentrate. I'm so overfilled with joy at what just happened. There's like scat and there's a dog. That's all you need to be an environmentalist. What I wrote to you to say tonight is that I've spent a truly irrational amount of my life wondering how we as a species are going to cope with such a rapidly changing present and future. How we can live through a sixth extinction and the realities of political and environmental refugees and a rapidly changing climate. But when I get to experience nights like tonight with this many people joined through ideas of place and regionalism and commitment to place and commitment to the people in those places, I feel a healing. How many of you, and you have to answer, with a show of loud activist voices, have pulled a carrot from the ground? That was better than I thought. I don't even need to read the poem because you know what I'm going to say. That sound of the snap, that sound as you're pulling the carrot out of the ground, that soft snap that happens, it's a sound that I carry with me. I'm going to read you a poem called Carrot. Planet spins toward today's end in the hulk of summer's harvest. Yanked the carrot right out of the dirt. Snap, snap went the cords of its life. The planet and I fed. The greens brushed my arm like so many families' hands missing from my life, their underground tethers. I bite deep into the carrot's core, snap, and the mulch of sweetness stings me. Revealed in the carrot's body is Fibonacci and the sequences of the living. See them in there, radiating ancestors like stars. I wonder how its spirit left, if the roots took themselves back to dirt like time's retrieval, or if it was rental. This orange death I stole, a car, a boat, home, or body, wandering this whole life long. At the time of this poem, I had lived in a densely populated neighborhood of Seattle for 3 years, Capitol Hill. And in the gravel parking lot of our apartment building, my partner and I built a food box. It was a beacon for us, those 11 inches of dirt, our most direct connection to the planet. By the second year, we had become pretty good growers. We produced kale, potatoes, snap peas, carrots. All summer, I watched them grow. And as summer hit its peak in mid-September, it was time to harvest. for me, as a minus two generational not farmer, many generations removed, harvesting was hard. Scissor blades on kale, the snap of the peas, the scooping of the golden potatoes. Hardest was the carrots. The morning I harvested my first carrot, the snap from its root encapsulated every loss I had ever felt. Lost family members, places, even memories. Snap, it all came back again. I stared at the dangling limp root for a long time, following the string to the past, then took a bite. In that bite was all the life that had ever lived, a sort of beauty of living I had never imagined. Then I remembered the ends of the roots still in the dirt. And if that carrot was ever mine to begin with, if anything we ever have is truly ours. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Janie. I think the planning mistake that we made was, last night was John Richards' show, but two nights ago was the Endangered Species Scatfest. And I think that gave Samson the dog a lot to think about. Next year we're going to do that differently. We want to mention, too, that Chris Jordan, who's on the program, is not going to be able to make it tonight. I believe he heard he was going to have to follow a dog and tapped out, which I don't blame him at all. I have good news, though, and that is that the Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance builds, maintains, and advocates for mountain bike trails across our state, and they're currently working on multiple projects in the Skycomish area, including a new trail at Alpine Baldy. Be a part of the biking community by joining Evergreen today.
Hello, my name is Colin Fogarty, and I love Seattle, in part because it's such a great public radio town. So if you'll indulge me, can we have a round of applause for our friends at KEXP? And then, of course, I want to give a shout out to our friends at KUOW. But today, I want to give a very special round of applause. Please join me in thanking KPLU for all of their excellent, excellent work over the years. We are with you, and we always will be. So, on with the show. My name is Colin Fogarty, and as I said, I spent 20 years in public radio. I should hug the mic, shouldn't I? I shouldn't walk away from the mic. And I told stories on public radio. That was my job. And I told too many stories to count. But what I always found was that the stories that I was most drawn to, the ones I could never forget, were the ones you could not see. The stories about invisible things. The stories about things that surround us always, but you cannot see. Stories about history. And at some point I realized history surrounds us always. If you listen to every story on the radio, it is always rooted in history. We just have to listen and see, and that's what drew me to Confluence. Confluence is a donor-supported nonprofit that connects people to place through art and education. And it's a series of six art spaces along the Columbia River system. And I'll tell you about each one. Five of them are by the celebrated artist Maya Lin, who shot to fame as the artist behind the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Yes, you can applaud. That's great. But don't forget, one of those projects was also done by this man, John Paul Jones, who is not the bass player for Led Zeppelin, but he is an amazing architect. Thank you, John Paul, for being here. All of these sites, these Confluence projects, are an attempt to reconnect people with the story of the peoples who lived here for thousands of years before Lewis and Clark happened through this era, this area. And it's about the ecological and the cultural changes that happened in the 200 years since the expedition. In short, this is the story of the Northwest. And when you think about what it means to be from this region, what do you think of? The beauty, the recreation, the hiking, maybe it's windsurfing. No matter what it is for you, we share a love of this place. This is our home, and appreciating its grandeur and its beauty is one way we connect to this place. But what if I told you this windsurfer, having a hilariously good time, was windsurfing over the most sacred and culturally significant place in the Northwest, bar none, the most sacred and culturally significant place in the Northwest, and I'm talking about Celilo Falls. It was a place known as the Wall Street of the West because it was a center of commerce, a center of culture for thousands of years. Celilo Falls was six times more powerful than Niagara Falls, the most productive fishing grounds in North America. And in 1957, it was flooded by the Dalles Dam. It's one of 32 dams along the Columbia River system. History surrounds us. Some of the electricity lighting this room likely comes from the Dalles Dam. So let's fast forward to 2001. Anton Minthorn fished Celilo Falls in 1956 when he was a young man. And in 2001, he was the tribal chair of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon. And he had seen dramatic and economic and ecological progress made by Northwest tribes, and he helped lead it. And in 2001, there was a big debate going on about whether and how the Native voice could be included in the discussion about all the undaunted courage demonstrated by those great explorers, Lewis and Clark. Hey, they met people. That's what Anton was thinking about. And what's more, those people are still here. And so he had a simple question. What is a legacy? What is their legacy? Sure, but what is our legacy? And the result of that discussion that ensued was confluence. First, they enlisted Maya Lin, and what she was interested in was not only the cultural and historical changes that occurred in the 200 years since Lewis and Clark, but also the environmental changes. By the way, these pictures, these stunning photos are by Glenn Nelson, so let's hear it up for him. Cape Disappointment on the Washington coast at the mouth of the Columbia River is where Lewis and Clark reached the Pacific Ocean and where Chinook people lived and fished. Maya helped redesign the park and create a working fish cleaning table that is etched with the creation story, the Chinook creation story. So as you are processing your fish, you are reminded that people have been fishing and living there since time immemorial. Next is the Confluence Land Bridge at Fort Vancouver, at the confluence of the Klickitat Trail and the Columbia River. This is the site designed by John Paul Jones. It reconnects the community with the river, a connection that had been broken by railroad tracks and a freeway. Moving east, the Confluence Bird Blind at the Sandy River Delta, not far from Portland, where Lewis and Clark could not sleep one night because they heard so many birds, and where a 1,500-acre wilderness is being restored today. Inside the bird blind are the names of 134 species documented by Lewis and Clark and their environmental status today. Still moving east in Pasco, Washington, at the confluence of the Snake and the Columbia Rivers, Maya Lin designed 7-story circles that reconnect people with the cultures and the flora and the fauna of a spot that's been a gathering place for thousands of years, not just a state park. It is a sacred place, and we should always be reminded of that. Along the Snake River near Clarkston, Washington, it's just across from Lewiston. Get it? Clarkston, Lewiston. So it's at the confluence, or near the confluence, of the Clearwater and the Snake River. Maya Lin designed a listening circle based on a Nez Perce blessing ceremony performed there in 2005. They created a spiritual landscape, and she built that into the land itself. And finally, Celilo Park near the Dalles, Oregon. The final confluence project will be an elevated walkway inspired by those traditional fishing platforms that will take you to where Celilo Falls still exist. We know this from sonar, but they're underwater, silent, and invisible. And more importantly, it will take you to Celilo Falls in your heart. We hope to be done with this project in 2017. History surrounds us. It's up to us to listen and to see. Thank you very much.
I'm going to talk about something that is dear to all of our hearts, and it's really strongly dear to the indigenous people of this area. And it has to do with some things called indigenous gifts. And they influence you all the time here in Seattle and in the Pacific Northwest. And they center around ancient gifts that come from a lot of experience over thousands of years. And it comes from verbal gifts that are passed down from generation to generation. And it also comes from emerging gifts that are happening around us all the time here in Seattle. So I'm going to speak a little bit about that, because that had a lot to do with the Confluence Project and Maya Lin. But first, I want to read this to you. Look at this poem. Anybody know who Chief Dan George was? Yeah. Well, he's a Coast Salish Indian man, and he was in a little big man, and he was dressed up like a Plains Indian, but he was north of us from here. He's Coast Salish. And he was a very good poet, and he said, "The beauty of the trees, the softness of the air, the fragrance of the grass speak to me. The summit of the mountains, the thunder of the sky, the rhythm of the sea speak to me. The faintness of the stars, the freshness of the morning, the dewdrop on flowers speak to me. The strength of fire, the taste of salmon, and the trail of the sun, and this is to me most important, and the life that never goes away, they speak to me, and my heart soars." So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. My heritage is Choctaw and Cherokee from Oklahoma. And my mother and grandmother said, "Anything you do, John Paul, make sure you pay close attention to the natural world, the animal world, the spirit world, and the human world." And in each one of those areas are a whole bunch of things that you can work with. And if you pay attention to those, just like that poem does, then life will never go away. So I'm going to read a little bit of it and just show you some images. "The beauty of trees speak to me. The softness of the air speak to me. The fragrance of grass speak to me. And they come from the natural world. Seasons and cycles, cardinal directions, and plants, and day and night." Let's see if I can keep it moving here. More of that poem, "The summit of the mountain, the thunder of the sky, the rhythm of the sea speak to me." That's here. That's why we live here. That's really important. And then there's the animal world, other living things that live with us here. Even in the city, they live with us on Green Lake or on Puget Sound. And they share the land, and they have a lot of power and strength. And we live in an area where they're expressed strongly in dancing and singing and that sort of thing. And they're related to wild places. And the faintness of the stars, the freshness of the morning, and the dewdrop on flowers speak to me. And a lot of that has to do with the spirit world. I'm not talking about church. I'm talking about creation and renewal, seasonal things, the spirit of rocks and dirt and soil that make carrots. And about birth and wellness, and I call round places. And the strength of fire, the taste of salmon, the trail of the sun. We get to see that right here in Seattle every evening over the Olympic Mountains. And that has a lot to do with our human world. And what I like to say the most important thing is in that is transfer of knowledge. That transfer of knowledge is a gift that we pass down and that indigenous people have been passing down for generations and generations here in Puget Sound. So I'm going to show you a little bit of a something of the land bridge, which is one of the Confluence projects. And It was at the first civilized place in the Northwest, Fort Vancouver. And the Hudson Bay Company was there. And why was the Hudson Bay Company there? Because it was a good place to trade. It was the Klickitat Trail came over from Eastern Washington, and it was a good trading place. And so Hudson Bay was a trading company, so they located there in that location. And then over many, many generations, Fort Vancouver lost its connection to the river by an intercontinental railroad and a highway. And so when Native people came to this place like they do for ceremonies now, they couldn't land their canoe on the beach and get to the fort. They had to go up into the city of Vancouver about 5 or 6 miles and come back around. So like that trail, we were reconnecting Fort Vancouver and the land with the Columbia River, and that's what the bridge is all designed about. It's designed about that reconnection. So I'll go along here. If you're ever flying into Portland Airport, look down on the Vancouver side, and if you see this curved bridge, that's the land bridge. There it is, looking sort of downriver. It's a very organic place. It has a lot of stories that are being told about the land, the water in the area, and it goes between, on the left side here, the Intercontinental Railroad and the highway on the right side. And it was a place where trash was dumped. And we were able to make it a place that connected land. And there's various words for land from the Chinook jargon that are expressed here. And we were able to make it a connection with the Native culture in the area. And I wanted to show you in the grand opening, there was a few people there that day. And it's a pretty special place that Maya and Lynn and I got to really have a fun thing doing. That's part of the Confluence Project. And it has to do with a life that never goes away. And they speak to me. Life never goes away. It's here. No matter what we do to it, it's here. And my heart soars. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me tonight. I'm super grateful to be here. I'm pretty sure I came out of the womb loving the wilderness, and by 3 months old, I was camping with my family on the North Fork of the Skykomish at Troublesome Creek. My dad fished, and my mom watched after us kids, and this is how it went for days on end, fishing, getting wet, hiking, and really just setting up home outside. Upon returning back to the suburbs of good old Kenmore, my dad would smoke his catch over alderwood, and to this day, the smell of smoking wood chips gives me pure, visceral joy. In my adulthood, I've adapted my own relationship with the outdoors and have come to respect the wild sometimes more than humanity. The sound of a river making its way over granite, turning corners over and under trees. The smell of baking pine needles in the high Sierra, blue sky above, no sound to be heard. My wetsuit-clad body diving under salty waves, nothing in the distance but the horizon and maybe a seal. Dripping cedars and moist ferns, the scent of wet, earthy, mushroomy goodness. The ever-quiet, majestic desert with her crystal granite rocks and cactus for days. These places all have a story, and I love to listen. For as long as I can remember, I've been gathering love, energy, and inspiration from these wild natural places and using her fuel to write my own story. Every rock, feather, crystal, bone, seed, branch, and leaf collected is a reminder of the most beautiful system I have witnessed. I took a year off after high school, and my only agenda was to be a snowboard bum in Tahoe. It was on the mountain where I discovered my interest in food. I moved back home, went to culinary school, and learned as much as I could about organic farming, composting, and big agriculture. I discovered what I didn't want to support in the food industry and what I was determined to accomplish in the food industry. And I learned just how much I love chocolate. I'll never forget the day I discovered that chocolate comes from the seed of a fruit. It blew my mind. I was working at Canlis, my only pastry chef job, and that day I knew I wanted to become a chocolatier. With chocolate, I could dive deeper into the social aspect and environmental aspect of farming, and I could use chocolate as my art form. Chocolate was my life, but still, I had a deep-rooted cosmic womb that yearned for nature, and so I brought nature into my work. As an homage to Northwest tradition and to my family, I found that chocolate is the perfect ingredient to smoke over alderwood. I began collecting rocks, sticks, and earth to use in my chocolate sculptures and infused wild roots, leaves, and medicinal herbs into chocolate. And this was just the beginning of bringing the wild into my desserts. After working as a chocolatier for years, I started my own organic dessert business, Hot Cakes. I began at the Ballard Farmers Market selling take-and-bake molten cakes in mason jars. Staying true to my love for the woods, I made sure these cakes could be taken on the trail and baked around a campfire. It became vital that my desserts would be woven into my passion for nature. Hot Cakes was about 4 years old when I began to question what my career was doing to better preserve nature. Supporting organic farmers has always been non-negotiable, but I've wanted to go deeper into supporting wildlife and wild places. I began to feel like chocolate and the food industry didn't fit into my heart any longer, that there are wild animals and forests that need saving, and I felt stuck in an industry that sometimes felt like it's more a part of the problem than it is a part of the solution. But food has been my life, and abandoning it also didn't feel right. So I've decided to put Hot Cakes to work as a vehicle to educate myself and others and support those who are fighting. I've created the Wilderness Collection, 4 caramel sauces infused with ingredients you would find on a hike, like stinging nettles that I harvest myself, juniper berry, white sage, and campfire smoke. Our smoked chocolate chips and s'mores kits are also a part of this collection, and 10% of the sales are donated to various wildlife conservation organizations. So here I am, coming into my 35th year of life, and I'm beginning to feel like I understand what it takes to always live from my heart in its ever-changing ways. And for me now, and as far as I can tell forever going forward, my heart is for the preservation, appreciation, and love for the wild that exists around us. Thank you.
Hello, Seattle. My name is Nikki McClure, and I grew up in Kirkland. I'm an East Sider, still live on the east side of Olympia, even. And I grew up looking at those amazing Olympic Mountains. They were always white, even in summer. And I would fall asleep every night watching and waiting for the Queen Anne lights to fall into sync, and then I'd fall asleep. I moved to Olympia 30 winters ago. There I start cutting paper and making paper cuts, and I make books, and I make a calendar every year. I've been making a calendar since 1998. That's a lot of Novembers and Decembers and Januaries. I think a lot about winter here. It is my work. Today is November 12th. The tide is falling in Seattle. It was high at 421 and will be low at 1112. It's a -1 in case you want to go clamming. The sun set at 437. The moon set at 542, and it's dark. Winter is here. This picture is myth. Persephone ate 6 pomegranate seeds, and here there will be no snowmen, No sleigh rides, no bells jingling. Here we will have snowberries to glow in this gloaming. Winter is dark, wet, dark, wet. This darkness matters and this wetness matters. It draws us in. It pulls us into all those coffee shops, into our home, and it creates industry. There's a nightly making and dreaming and scheming of impossibilities, and we work into the night. The New York Times is read 3 months late, then crumpled up and burnt. No one needs a jeweled butterfly watch. No one. There are so many jeweled watch ads in the New York Times. But we do need butterflies. How many did you see this summer? Work. In winter, my work begins. I rake up remnants of summer. These leaves are beyond big, the hands of giants that have made by capturing every particle of light and transforming it into solid gold, and I hoard it. My investment strategy is to rake a pile as tall as a tall enough, maybe I might need one of those cranes, to be a 20-unit apartment tower that overlooks the Salish Sea. You can move in next week. The rooms will be ready. And here I will burrow down. The warmth of my work will match the warmth of the leaves. We will decompose together. We will recompose, rewrite, and rewrite our story all winter long. This is my work. I will hide beneath these leaves all winter. Winter. It is the work. It is the dark. It is the gathering. Buffleheads. Buffleheads returned October 31st to Bud Inlet in Olympia. I've been watching and hoping ever since the leaves fell and the raking began, and I worry that maybe there'd be no buffleheads this year. But they're there now, their bright white heads made brighter against the gray day. 30 winters ago when I moved to Olympia, there were thousands and thousands of western grebes whistling and diving and feeding in huge rafts. 2 years ago, I saw one grebe. Last year, I saw none. Zero. This year, on September 27th, I saw six. And is this hope? Six is not 3,000. Six is not 500. Six is not even 100. But it is six. And those six western grebes are beautiful, and I will make a picture of them. Those red eyes slipping under the water. But is this hope? How can we note this dwindling if we're not sitting on the beach waiting and hoping? We're driving in cars with the windows too fogged up to see. We have to use those squeegees here. And it's dark and we want to go home and make dinner. How will we know there's no buffleheads if we don't even know what a bufflehead is? If we don't know that they always arrive in late October after a summer spent in the north on a lake, raising their babies in a hole made by a flicker? How will we know if we don't stop to notice what we have here now? This is Thrill. This song, Sparrows, stopped me on a foggy morning walk, and I stayed for its concert. Or was it something else? Was it communicating joy, sorrow, thrill, hope? There were butterflies, but they were less. The winter birds have returned, but they are less. My song will be of the six, the hope of the six. My song will be of waiting on the beach. My song will welcome the buffleheads. My song will be raking leaves and decomposing and burning that news for warmth. That is how I will make my winter here. In hope and in making. But what is the winter hope to Californians or Pennsylvanians or people in Louisiana? What is hope to them this winter? And what is hope to you here in Seattle? How will you spend this winter here? Will you walk the beach? Will you know the tides? Will you sing to a western grebe? Will you gather by a fire and dream and conspire impossibilities into action? Winter is here. Make it warm with your work. Thank you.
Wow. That was Nikki McClure with a clear message. Winter is coming. No word on if Jon Snow is really dead. Half of you got that joke. Half of you are like, I don't even have a TV. And I can't be friends with you.
That's it for this broadcast of Speakers Forum. You can hear a full podcast of Ampersand Live on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. This event took place at Town Hall Seattle on November 12, 2015. Thank you again to Florangela Davila for providing our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum. Good night.